The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the November 10th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has in the background the White House, and on the front lawn in the foreground, way in front of the White House, is a series of dominoes. The dominoes, the first few have faces on them. The first says Manafort, and the second says Papadopoulos. The third looks like it says Gates. And then you can't see the rest of the dominoes, but the first one is falling and looks like it's going to hit the others and fall back. The title says, The First to Fall. Where is Mueller's investigation headed? And that will be our first main story. First indictments in the Mueller investigation. What happened? The investigation into Russian interference in last year's election shifted into a major new phase this week when special counsel Robert Mueller unveiled charges against three Trump campaign officials, including former campaign chairman Paul Manafort, and produced the most explicit evidence to date that Trump's team sought assistance from Russian operatives. Manafort and his longtime business partner Rick Gates were indicted on a dozen charges relating to their lobbying work for a Kremlin-backed political party in Ukraine between 2006 and 2015. The indictment accuses the two men of laundering tens of millions of dollars through a complex web of foreign corporations and bank accounts, giving Justice Department investigators false or misleading statements, and violating several lobbying and banking laws. Both men pleaded not guilty. Manafort was deemed a flight risk. He had three U.S. passports, and he and Gates were placed under house arrest. In what might prove to be a more significant development, Mueller's team also revealed they had struck a plea deal with former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos to provide information to investigators after he admitted having lied to them about his contacts with Russian officials. Court documents show that Papadopoulos met Joseph Mifsud, a London-based professor with connections to the Kremlin, shortly after joining Trump's campaign in March last year. Over the next 3 to 4 months, Mifsud introduced Papadopoulos to at least two other Kremlin-linked individuals and told him Moscow had dirt on Hillary Clinton in the form of thousands of emails. Papadopoulos repeatedly tried to broker a meeting between Trump and his top aides and the Russian government. Manafort, the indictment said, wrote in an email Trump should not do such a meeting. It should be someone low level in the campaign so as not to send any signal, Manafort wrote. President Trump dismissed Papadopoulos on Twitter as a low-level volunteer and a proven liar. He said that the Manafort accusations were from years ago and insisted there was no collusion. The president was reportedly fuming over the indictments, but was resisting calls from former chief strategist Steve Bannon and other outside advisors to fire Mueller before he succeeds in getting other aides to become cooperating witnesses. The walls are closing in, one senior Republican told the Washington Post. Everyone is freaking out. What the editorial said. Mueller's indictments should put to rest the claim that the Russia investigation is a witch hunt, said the New York Daily News. While working on Trump's campaign, Papadopoulos met and corresponded with Kremlin-linked operatives on several occasions. He shared details of his Russian outreach at a meeting attended by Trump, and his Russian connection dangled the promise of releasing thousands of emails that would hurt Clinton an offer he almost certainly passed on to his superiors. Those emails were released by WikiLeaks a few months later. Yes, some officials in the Trump campaign were clearly interested in forming a relationship with Moscow, said NationalReview.com. But Papadopoulos, a 30-year-old foreign policy neophyte, was a marginal player in Trump world, and his attempt to schedule a Trump-Putin meeting failed. As for Manafort, his alleged crimes took place years before he joined the Trump campaign and thus have nothing to do with collusion. Well, the columnist said, these indictments are just the beginning, said former prosecutor Paul Callan in CNN.com. Mueller and his team of highly sophisticated, experienced prosecutors are sending a message that anyone who lies to them during this investigation will face felony charges, and that cooperating may be the only way to avoid a prison sentence. In focusing on Manafort's business dealings, Mueller is indicating that an examination of Trump's pre-campaign business operations is now a real possibility. The worst thing that Trump can do is panic, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. There are no signs Manafort knows details of a collusion scheme. If he did, he surely would have flipped by now. And Papadopoulos' indictment proves nothing concrete. If Trump fired Mueller in frustration and fear, he'd ignite an all-consuming political crisis, and all of the special counsel's findings would be handed to Congress and become part of impeachment hearings. Trump haters may be howling with glee, said Ed Rogers in WashingtonPost.com, but this indictment is not a direct hit. The big question now is whether Mueller will start digging into Trump's tax matters and business dealings that predate his presidency. Is that really fair game? So far, there's no smoking gun on collusion, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. But consider what we already know. Trump's campaign was filled with people who had secretive and shady connections with Russia and were eager to meet Russians offering dirt on Clinton. At least one advisor knew about Moscow's hacked emails before they were published. And after becoming president, Trump fired his FBI director and publicly admitted he did so to end the Russia thing, an act that may lead to an obstruction of justice charge. Given all of these known facts, is it really possible that there were no explicit cooperation between Russia and the Trump campaign? Our controversy of the week, the Steele dossier, making sense of a new revelation. After a year of rumor and speculation, we finally have our most tangible evidence that U.S. parties conspired with Russia to influence the 2016 U.S. election, said David Harsanyi in the New York Post. The culprits? Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. Last week, the Washington Post broke the story that the infamous Steele dossier, a sheaf of unsubstantiated claims about Donald Trump's ties to Russia that circulated in media and government circles in the months before the election, was in fact paid for by the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. Funding for the project, a reported $9 million, was funneled discreetly through a friendly law firm to the research firm Fusion GPS, which hired Christopher Steele, a former British intelligence officer, to research and compile the dossier. Steele paid for information from Russian contacts. What a sudden about-face from the dominant media narrative of the last year, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Liberals have been hyperventilating over the possibility of President Trump's alleged complicity in Russian election meddling. But what we know for sure was that Democrats paid for Russians to compile wild allegations about a U.S. presidential candidate. Did someone say collusion? What a disingenuous and nonsensical attempt to confuse the public, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Opposition research is commonplace and hardly a scandal. Still didn't work for Russia or any other government. To find out about Trump and his campaign's dealings with Russia, he naturally spoke to Russians with knowledge of their government's attempts to cultivate the Republican candidate and his aides. Finally, the Clinton campaign never publicized any of Steele's findings or used them in campaign ads. The report became public weeks after Trump was elected. Besides, who cares who paid for Steele's work, says Alex Shepard in NewRepublic.com. It doesn't affect the substance of the dossier, which the FBI and other federal investigators have largely corroborated. The Russians did wage an orchestrated campaign to woo Trump aides and entangle them in their scheme to produce a pro-Russian administration. It very much matters who paid for Steele's shoddy dossier, said Molly Hemingway in TheFederalist.com. The FBI may have relied on this politically motivated hatchet job to obtain surveillance warrants against members of Trump's inner circle during the Obama administration. When FBI Director James Comey briefed President-elect Trump about its contents in January, that news really got the ball rolling on the conspiracy theory that Trump colluded with Russia, eventually leading to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's massive, sprawling, limitless probe. What we've just learned, in short, is that the Russia scare consuming the nation's attention had its basis in a partisan, Democratic effort to harm Trump in the 2016 election and beyond. Behold Trump's biggest disinformation campaign yet, said Max Boot in foreignpolicy.com. The Steele dossier was not the basis of the unanimous assessment by U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia hacked Democratic computers and meddled in our election to help Trump. Putin emphatically did not want that known, so the idea that the Russian government played some role in the Steele dossier is absurd. The dossier is at most a sideshow in the Russia scandal. With Mueller and his untouchables producing the first indictment in what will no doubt be a damning investigation, Trump's frantic loyalists have resorted to echoing their leader's grade school retort to Clinton during one of their debates. No puppet, no puppet, you're the puppet. And it was a good week for innate talent. After a bored 10-year-old boy stole his mother's boyfriend's car and led police on an hour-long chase through Cleveland, reaching speeds of up to 100 miles per hour. He was a good driver, one eyewitness said. I don't see how he even looked over the steering wheel. It was a good week for booty shakers. With the repeal, after 91 years, of New York's Prohibition-era cabaret law, which banned dancing in the city's bars. The only thing we are asking is to move our bodies rhythmically, said one bar owner. And it was a good week for man's best friend, after two new studies found that people have more empathy for dogs suffering pain than human beings in pain, and would be more likely to donate money to save a homeless dog than a homeless person. But it was a bad week for giving in after a goalkeeper was kicked out of a British soccer game for sneaking over to the side of the field and urinating. I was in a very uncomfortable position, said goalie Max Crocombe, and made an error in judgment. It was a bad week for Barack Obama, who will interrupt his lucrative post-presidential life to report for jury duty next month in Illinois. If selected to be a juror, Obama will earn $17.20 a day for his service. And finally, it was a bad week for trolls. After Roger Stone, the eccentric former Trump advisor, had his Twitter account permanently suspended for a series of expletive-filled attacks on CNN anchors. Stone also accused Weekly Standard editor Bill Kristol of packing on the pounds, hashtag Porky. Well, before we leave here, let's take in this boring but important short piece. It says, transgender military ban blocked by judge. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. this week partially blocked President Trump's order banning transgender people from serving in the military, arguing that the policy does not appear to be supported by any facts. Six active duty transgender soldiers with decades of combined military service had sued to block the directive, which Judge Colleen Collar Caudley ruled would harm troop morale rather than ease disruption, as Trump had suggested. Collar Caudley also criticized Trump's initial decision to announce the transgender ban over Twitter, catching military leaders unaware. The Trump administration said the judge's ruling was premature, given that the Pentagon is still evaluating how to oppose the directive. The title of the article on the briefing page this week is The Electric Car Revolution. Is the era of the conventional combustion engine coming to an end? How popular are electric cars? Right now, they make up just 1% of the global automobile market. But sales jumped 36% last year to 750,000 worldwide. And China, the world's largest car market, is betting big on electric. In September, Beijing announced its plan to completely ban the sale of gas and diesel vehicles at some future unannounced date. While India, Britain, France, and other countries have set their own 2030 or 2040 deadlines, U.S. automakers are now racing to get a piece of the emerging electric market. GM and Ford have promised to roll out a combined total of more than 30 electric models by 2023. Volvo will introduce only battery-powered or hybrid new models starting in 2019. The range and speed of electric vehicles is constantly improving. When their upfront sales price finally matches a conventional car's, that's when the real shift occurs, said Colin McCaricher, head of advanced transport analysis at Bloomberg News, at Bloomberg New Energy Finance. Why are sales growing? It's partly thanks to Tesla, whose luxury Model S transformed the image of electric cars from sluggish, small, and boxy vehicles to sleek, powerful machines. One version of the Model S can go from 0 to 60 miles per hour in 2.28 seconds, quicker than a Ferrari. But the most important factor has been the major advances in lithium-ion batteries, whose cost plunged from $1,000 per kilowatt hour in 2010 to $300 today. As a result, automakers have been able to develop several mass-market options that, after subsidies, are less than the median U.S. car price of $34,968. Tesla has already received 400,000 pre-orders of its mass-market Model 3, which starts at $36,200. The Chevy Bolt and Nissan Leaf start at $37,495 and $30,680, respectively. Still, people don't buy cars based solely on the price tag, said Sam Ory, executive director of the University of Chicago's Energy Policy Institute, and a number of other obstacles remain, such as the biggest is range anxiety. Car buyers still worry that an electric car could run out of battery juice during a long journey, leaving them stranded. In fact, while early electric car models needed a recharge every 100 miles or so, today's electric cars have a range of between 200 and 330 miles, close to that of your conventional fuel tank. That covers 87% of an average person's driving needs, according to one study. But consumers remain nervous. They tend to set their requirement based on their worst-case specification, said Sam Abuelasmid, a senior analyst at Navigant Research. What about other concerns? Automakers also have to contend with charging time trauma. Electric car drivers who choose to charge their car at home through a regular 110-volt wall plug can do so for as little as $1 for a full battery, but they will often have to wait up to 10 hours for a complete recharge. Or they can go for a fast charge at a public charging station. The U.S. has 43,000. China is planning to extend its 150,000 existing spots to 4.8 million by 2020. Those public charging points, many of them free, use 240-volt and 480-volt chargers that drop the rejuice time to 20 or 30 minutes. Charge times are constantly falling, and cities are pouring money into charging infrastructure, just as lawmakers have heavily subsidized the cars themselves. What incentives do governments offer? In the U.S., a federal rebate program gives electric vehicle buyers a $7,500 tax credit for the first 200,000 vehicles a car maker delivers. States offer their own generous goodies on top of that, including tax credits, free parking spots, and preferential highway lanes. China and Denmark give motorists a 23% and 49% discount on electric cars, respectively. These subsidies are crucial to the survival of the electric car market. Even with the plunge in prices, lithium-ion batteries still add about $20,000 to the cost of an electric car, making plug-ins unaffordable without rebates and tax credits. But electric car proponents think they have two big factors on their side: China and basic economics. Why is China so important? The Chinese government is doubling down on electric, not just to reduce the choking smog blanketing its cities, but also to help its car manufacturers seize control of the global automobile market. Those manufacturers have already developed 100 electric models, leaving the other nations' automakers in the dust. Even without Beijing's push, many analysts believe the electric cars had the winning economic formula. So much so that researchers at Bloomberg New Energy Finance estimate plug-ins will make up the majority of cars worldwide by 2040. Electric vehicles, EVs, have fewer than 20 moving parts, as opposed to 2,000 in combustion engines, and thus require less maintenance. Their fuel costs are much lower. When upfront prices finally drop to below those of gas guzzlers, says Tona Seba of technology think tank RethinkX, the rational economic choice will be to buy the EV. How green are electric cars? Every self-respecting environmentalist drives a hybrid or a plug-in. But these vehicles may not be as low emission as many proud owners believe. While all electrics produce zero emissions on the road, their batteries get their juice from power plants, many of which generate electricity by burning the dirtiest fuel of all, coal. By way of comparison, gas-powered cars produce an average of 411 grams of carbon dioxide per mile, In California, which has a high proportion of clean electricity from solar or wind power, an electric car produces 100 grams of greenhouse gas pollution per mile. If you're recharging in Minnesota, though, where most of the electricity is coal generated, that figure rises to 300 grams. As power plants get cleaner in the future, thanks to the continuing decline in coal-fired plants and to carbon capture and other technologies, it's more logical to focus on the source of the problem, says Qin Li Hong, president of electric automaker NextEV. It's much easier for society to make hundreds of power plants better, says Qin, than change the hundreds of millions of cars in thousands of cities. Moving into the best columns now, we'll take two this week from the U.S. The first is from Ann Applebaum at the Washington Post. Why Putin hates U.S. sanctions. The sanctions on Russia are working, said Ann Applebaum. Moscow's spitting fury serves as proof. Canadian lawmakers last week passed their own version of the Magnitsky Act, a series of U.S. sanctions named after a lawyer who died in grisly circumstances in a Moscow prison after uncovering a vast government corruption scandal. The Magnitsky Act deprives specific Russian oligarchs and Putin cronies of access to Western banks, Western vacation homes, and Western educations for their children. Putin really, really hates the Magnitsky sanctions and the other sanctions slapped on his inner circle by the Obama administration. The Kremlin responded to Canada's lawmakers by issuing an international arrest warrant for Bill Browder, the U.S.-born businessman who led the campaign to pass the Magnitsky Act, the fifth time it has done so. Putin's fervent desire to get the sanctions lifted also motivated his government's campaign to damage Hillary Clinton in 2016 and curry favor with Donald Trump and his aides. In Russia, the sanctions have generated huge anger among the wealthy elites, much of it directed quietly at Putin himself, who has failed to get them lifted. We must make sure he never succeeds. And this from Nicholas Kristof at the New York Times. Nerve gas in your dinner. The fruit and vegetables you and your kids eat may be contaminated with a nerve gas originally developed by Nazi Germany, said Nicholas Kristof. It's a pesticide called chlorpyrifos, made by the Dow Chemical Company, and studies have found that it damages the brain, reduces IQs, and has been linked to lung cancer and Parkinson's disease. The Environmental Protection Agency banned chlorpyrifos, or as I prefer to call it, the, quote, nerve gas pesticide, for indoor residential use 17 years ago, and was finally preparing to ban it for agricultural and outdoor use this year. But after Dow donated $1 million to President Trump's inauguration committee, the EPA reversed course. So chlorpyrifos will keep getting sprayed on the food we eat and on golf courses, so it trickles into the water we drink. Toxic chemicals already can be found in nearly all our bodies and could be playing a role in the widening epidemic of lowered male sperm counts and infertility, developmental disorders, cancer, and other serious maladies. While everyone is diverted by the daily White House fireworks, this administration is handing the keys of our regulatory apparatus to the American Chemistry Council and other industry groups. It will be a lasting and toxic legacy. And this is a How They See Us column in the international page, a shift toward India. It seems that the India-U.S. bonhomie has reached a new high, said the Daily News and Analysis from India in an editorial. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was full of praise for New Delhi last week as he toured India, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. He spoke of how our two nations' partnership would endure for the next 100 years and effectively promised to support India's rise as a leading power. The Trump administration is cultivating India as a counterweight to China, whose growing clout in the subcontinent and in the South China Sea area has become a global concern. And this is not just rhetoric. The U.S. offered to supply India with F-16 and F-18 fighter jets, as well as armed Predator drones. Equally telling was how negative Tillerson was towards Pakistan, said the Times of India. The secretary and his aides warned Islamabad that it had to crack down on the numerous Islamist terrorist groups that find safe haven inside of Pakistan, or the U.S. would adjust its tactics and strategies accordingly. The U.S. has already made clear what this adjusted, less diplomatic approach might look like. Tillerson's visit was preceded by dozens of drone strikes on suspected militants inside Pakistan and the expulsion of a prominent Pakistani bank from the U.S. because of its failure to comply with laws on money laundering and terrorist financing. The Trump administration has many more tools at its disposal if Pakistan remains defiant or in denial. The U.S. has put Pakistan in an impossible position, said Mur Akram and Dawn from Pakistan. It wants us to attack the Afghan Taliban and its allies so that American troops stay in Afghan will be as comfortable as possible. We know what would happen next. The Afghan Taliban would retaliate with terrorist attacks in Pakistan, and our nation would no longer be able to act as an impartial intermediary in the peace talks between the Afghan government and the militants. This will prolong Afghanistan's civil war, the suffering of its people, and instability in the region. Worse, the U.S. is tacitly condoning increased Indian aggression in the disputed Kashmir region. Now is the time for China, the dragon in the room, to respond. China was on Pakistan's side during all previous Pakistan-India crises, including the 1965 and 1971 wars, and it surely does not want to see the U.S. use India against it. Let's hope when Trump goes to Beijing next week, Chinese President Xi Jinping will express his opposition to America's India-centric policies. Partnership with Washington is certainly an opportunity for India, said the Indian Express in an editorial. But trusting the Trump administration is tricky. Given the upheaval in Trump's cabinet, Tillerson may not last long at state. And Trump's policy flip-flops are well documented. While on his trip to China, he could well change his mind on India. Our leaders in New Delhi should see the new U.S. relationship not as a done deal, but as a work in progress. Time for the last word, our in-depth feature article, this week titled, Learning to Be Americans. Dozens of refugees attend Chicago's Sullivan High, where hijabs are as common as high tops, said Illy Fishman. Teachers say the presence of so many foreign-born students has given the once-failing school a new purpose. Sarah Quintenz is running late. She is due in the front office for a new student enrollment, but first she needs to find someone who speaks Arabic. Second period has just ended, so the teacher scans the crowded hallway outside her first floor classroom. Finally, she spots a Syrian-born student down the corridor. She shouts to him, telling him to follow her to the office. When they get there, a small crowd has already gathered. At the center stands 14-year-old Mohammed Nasser. Quintens doesn't know the particulars of his story, just that he and his family fled Iraq. They have been in the United States for all of 3 weeks. He is flanked by an older brother and a 4-year-old sister who can't stop giggling. A representative of the refugee resettlement agency Heartland Alliance accompanies them. "Hi, how are you?" Quintens asks. Mohammed smiles, bewildered. Quintens plows ahead. "Are you nervous? Scared?" The Syrian student begins to translate, but Quintens cuts him off. "I need to know if he speaks any English." It only takes a few seconds to assess that Mohammed doesn't. "He's 1A, Quintens proclaims to the school counselor nearby. The conversation continues, Quintens relying on the Syrian student and Daniel Riggs, an AmeriCorps tutor, conversant in Arabic to translate. "Tell him it's really important that he get here right at 8 a.m., Quintent says. "Actually, tell him to get here at 7:50. The next several minutes are spent showing Mohammed his two uniforms, a T-shirt and a polo with the school's logo, the Wi-Fi password, and his schedule. Something makes Mohammed and the Syrian boy laugh. "See? They're already friends," Quintin says to no one in particular. She then asks if Mohammed has a ride to school tomorrow. "We need to make sure he has a way here, because we're filled up on students getting lost on the first day." Quintin says her goodbye, and as she's leaving, Mohammed turns to Riggs and asks him a question in Arabic. Riggs points to the insignia on the tile floor. "Sullivan," he answers. "This is Sullivan High School." If Sullivan High School has a motto, it would be, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." Its immigrant population now numbers close to 300, 45% of the school's 641 students, and many are refugees new to this country. This academic year alone, the school in Chicago's Rogers Park neighborhood has welcomed a staggering 89 refugees, nearly three times as many as last year, and far more than any other high school in the city. The recent surge, fueled in part by an influx of Syrians, has turned the school into a global melting pot, with 38 countries and more than 35 languages represented. The third most common language after English and Spanish, spoken at Sullivan, Swahili. How Sullivan got to this point is a fascinating story of a school that not long ago was struggling for survival. When Chad Adams stepped in as principal in 2013, the school had been on academic probation for 8 years running. Its 4-year graduation rate hovered at a woeful 54%. Classrooms were barely half full, and violent incidents were common. "It was a place you wouldn't want to send your kids," said Adams, 40. But when Adams first walked through the school's doors that July, he ran into a group of students participating in a summer program for refugees. "I had never really met kids from all over the world before," he says. "You get to know these kids, and you see that they have an appreciation for a free education that sometimes Americans take for granted. It was really profound to me." He filed that experience away and spent his first year observing how the school operated. He noticed a large number of older kids who were regular no-shows. So at the end of his first year, he pushed them out, moving them to an alternative schools and GED programs. "What's your motivation to come to school as an 18-year-old with 3 credits? Your motivation is to hang out and mess around." Since Chicago Public Schools had already allocated funds based on projected enrollment, Adams now had some extra cash to play with. He decided to pour it into the school's English Language Learner Program, ELL, designed for refugees and other immigrants who speak little or no English. In essence, he was creating a new mission for the school. Still, keeping up with shifts in refugee populations presents a constant challenge for Adams and his staff. New foreign conflicts create new crops of students. What worked for a heavily Bhutanese population, there were some 90 such students in the school when Adams took over, may not work with Syrian kids. We're struggling a little bit in the sense that I don't know exactly how to manage this. But when you see a number like that going up, you know you have to do something, says Adams. There is no other place in the world that is doing what we are doing. I mean, this is like what America might be in 50 years. As students trickle in just before 12:30 p.m., Sarah Quintin's classroom is a cacophony of languages. Arabic, French, Rohingya, Swahili, Urdu. Nearly every inch of wall is covered in flags, posters, or photos of students. Plastic globes hang from the lights, and pictures of Quintin's young son dot the walls, each one accompanied with a direction, such as, clean up after yourself, your mother doesn't work here, or don't be afraid to swim in the deep end. Good afternoon, how are you? Quintin says to the class, her husky voice booming over the chatter. Fine, thank you. How are you? Her students reply in unison. This is Quintin's English 2B class, which means that the 30 students, all foreign-born, have a competent level of English. Many of them are in their second year at the school. That's in contrast to the 1A class for those like Mohammed who speak no English. It's called the silent class because pictures rather than words are used as the primary means of communication. Quintin's class looks like a junior United Nations. The front row is occupied by a quartet of girls from Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, wearing hijabs. In the back sit a group of boys from Uganda, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Among the five of them, they speak Swahili, Kinyarwanda, French, and Kirundi. In most conversations, soccer is a favorite topic, moves seamlessly from one language to another. Across the room, beneath the windows, a cluster of Malaysian, Burmese, and Congolese boys hover over their phones, playing video pool. During lunch, they often pile onto the couch in Quintin's room, stacking themselves like pancakes. You don't see American teenage boys hang off each other like that, notes Quintin's. One afternoon, at my request, Quintin's has her students fill out questionnaires that ask for details of their journeys to America. The assignment doubles as a lesson on grammar and punctuation. A Rohingya boy explains that as members of a persecuted Muslim minority, he and his family fled Myanmar for Bangladesh, then Malaysia, after his grandfather and uncle were killed. Another student outlines eight countries, Angola, Malawi, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe among them, that her family has lived in since leaving Rwanda. One girl, who has been in the United States for only a few months, says that she misses the smell of jasmine in her native Syria, but not the sound of bombs. Trauma is part of the cultural fabric in Room 106. The National Child Traumatic Stress Network reports that as many as 75% of refugee youths experience some level of post-traumatic stress disorder. That's why Chad Adams had every ELL teacher go through two trauma trainings. For Quintin's, helping students heal comes down to trust. Kids are only going to talk to you if you build those relationships and they feel comfortable with you. Though Quintin's prides herself on her close ties with her students, they're my minions, she jokes. There are some cultural gulfs she can't bridge. Last year, she had a 15-year-old freshman from Myanmar who was very bubbly and very happy and driven, Quintin's recalls. But over the course of the year, it was like reviving Ophelia as I watched her just slowly start to decline and become introverted. After months of this, Quintin's finally asked the student what was wrong. She just threw her arms around me and hung off my shoulders and said, "My parents are making me get married." The student showed up to school only a few more times before the end of the year. Now she's pregnant and married to a 24-year-old who lives with his father. I saw pictures from her wedding, and she looked miserable, says Quintenz. It was totally heartbreaking. During her 5 years as an ELL teacher, Quintenz has had a front row seat to some meteoric transformations. She has watched Muslims exchange hijabs for braids. She has seen girls who never wore makeup before suddenly paint their lips bright red, and boys who came in with a buttoned-up look start sagging their pants. They change really quickly, says Quintenz. It's a crazy thing to watch. The poster child is Thang Khan Kup, a 17-year-old from Myanmar. In the 3 years since Kup, as he prefers to be called, arrived in the United States, he has immersed himself in American culture. He's on the school's soccer and volleyball teams and plays guitar in a student rock band. His unofficial uniform is a denim jacket, a well-worn T-shirt, and frayed but fitted jeans. He cites Slash of Guns N' Roses as a style icon. And his main means of transportation to school is a skateboard. Which is to say he's like a lot of American kids, except for a major difference. 7 years ago, he was living in a small village in Myanmar. After the military tried to recruit his dad and older brother as battlefield porters in the country's civil war, Kup and his family fled south in the middle of the night. It took more than a week of walking through the jungle at night, like ninjas, Kup says, their legs covered in leeches, to reach Malaysia, where the family spent 4 years before relocating to Chicago. Two of Kup's first friends at Sullivan were also refugees, one from Tanzania and the other from Iraq. Their freshman year, the boys were almost always together, playing video games and talking soccer. There's a feeling we share, Kup says. We are refugees. Now that they are juniors, they spend less time with one another. These days, Kup mostly hangs out with his American friends from band and business class. But no matter how much he embraces this country, Kup says, he will never feel fully American. I am still Burmese. I just live in America for my safety. Refugee students often find themselves in a strange middle space, trying to balance life as an American teenager and cultural traditions from their homelands. Every day after school, Samira Ahmed, a Somali student, picks up her 8-year-old sister, Intisar, from a nearby elementary school. And every day, Samira asks her in Somali about her day. Sometimes Intisar replies in Somali, other times in English. She's forgetting our language, says Samira with a sigh. She's so American now. Samira, who has been in Chicago for a little over 2 years, lives with her mother, stepfather, and three younger sisters in a sparse three-room basement apartment just a few blocks from Sullivan. The only things in the living room are a bunk bed for Samira and two of her three sisters, a TV, and a smattering of baby toys and clothes. It doesn't take long to see that Samira is a mother figure to her siblings. She makes sure that Intisar does her homework and that everyone has had enough to eat. Lately, Samira's mother, who was married at 14, has been bugging the 19-year-old about finding a husband. Every day she's asking me if I want to get married, says Samira. She brings over old men, young men, every day she's asking me. But Samira has no interest in getting married at this stage. Maybe if she were still in Africa, she says, she would feel differently. But now that she is in the United States, she has other plans. I want to go to college and become a doctor. I want to show my family that I can take care of them and that I am the brain. Only after that will I get married. Life is not about running. I want to go slow. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Chicago Magazine. Thank you. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The black actor who refused to be stereotyped. Robert Guillaume, 1927 to 2017. When Robert Guillaume won the role of Benson, a black butler in a white household on ABC's soap opera satire Soap, 1977 through 81, the actor initially had misgivings. "You're serving food, you're serving the family," he said. "It's like nothing has changed since the 1800s. So Guillaume decided Benson wouldn't adhere to the racial stereotypes of the time. He'd be more erudite, dignified, and sharp-witted than his employers, a servant who refused to be serviles. Viewers loved the character, so much so that ABC gave him a spinoff show, Benson, from 1979 through 86, in which the butler worked for a state governor and eventually becomes a politician himself. Guillaume was proud of Benson's progress. "I always wanted the character to have that kind of upward mobility," he said. "It mirrored the American dream." Born in St. Louis, Guillaume grew up in poverty, said the New York Times. His father abandoned his mother, an alcoholic prostitute, before he was born. Guillaume was raised by his grandmother after his stepfather struck him in the head with a red-hot poker. After briefly serving in the Army in World War II, Guillaume enrolled at St. Louis University to study business. But his real passion was the stage. He left school to serve as an apprentice at theaters in Aspen, Colorado, and Cleveland, and in 1960 he moved to New York City. Guillaume quickly established himself as a force to be reckoned with, said NBCNews.com. He earned a Tony nomination in 1977 for his role in the first all-black version of Guys and Dolls, and won two Emmy Awards for his work as Benson. Guillaume broke new ground in 1989 with a self-titled show about a black marriage counselor in a relationship with a white woman, said The Guardian. It was canceled after just 12 episodes and remains the only series built around an interracial relationship to have aired on U.S. network television. Guillaume remained a prolific actor. He voiced the mandrel Rafiki in Disney's 1994 animated film The Lion King and played a TV producer on the Aaron Sorkin series Sports Night from 1998 to 2000. But he always felt Benson was the part he was born to play. His role, he said, was revenge for all those stereotyped guys who looked like Benson and had to keep their mouths shut. And we'll just turn right from there to the talking points page. Let's see. The GOP civil war. Has Trump won? "Everyone's talking about the civil war in the Republican Party," said the Weekly Standard in an editorial. "It seems more like a surrender to us. The past few weeks have seen extraordinary attacks on President Trump's leadership and fitness for office from the likes of outgoing senators such as Jeff Flake and Bob Corker, and even former President George W. Bush. But most Republican officials who hope to have a political future have quietly fallen in line. When asked about their policy positions, Republican leaders cowed by the pro-Trump base now say, 'I'm with the president,' sometimes without knowing where Trump stands. Even Senator Ted Cruz, who pointedly refused to endorse Trump at last year's convention, has called on Trump critics in the GOP to shut up and do your job. In other words, the Trumpian cult of personality has won. Has a hostile takeover of a historic institution ever been accomplished with less resistance? No doubt about it, the Republican Party is now the party of Trump," said Gloria Borger in CNN.com. "Among all voters, Trump has a historically low approval rating in the mid-30s, but an 82% approval rating among Republican voters. By a ratio of 2-1, Republican voters also trust Trump more than congressional Republicans. Translation: give 'em hell, Donnie. On most policy issues, the Republican establishment and Trump mostly agree, said Greg Sargent in the WashingtonPost.com. What separates them is the establishment's chagrin over Trump's authoritarian pronouncements, race baiting, and sophomoric tweets. The GOP civil war is really a battle over whether Republican lawmakers should or should not genuflect before Trump. Like it or not, Trump is more in touch with the Republican zeitgeist than most Republicans, said Matt Lewis in the DailyBeast.com. While establishment Republicans see chaos, Trump's fans see victories everywhere. To them, picking a fight with the NFL is just as good as repealing Obamacare. Maybe better in a pop culture reality TV world. That's one reason congressional Republicans can't turn on the man the voters stuck them with, said Jonathan Tobin in NationalReview.com. The other is that with control of the White House and Congress, Republicans have a rare and probably narrow window to push through a conservative agenda, and they don't want it derailed by party infighting or an impeachment battle. As flawed as Trump might be, he's their only hope of getting anything done. Well, on the heels of that, there is a relevant poll watch blurb. It says that 70% of Americans feel that the nation's political divide is at least as big as during the Vietnam War. 70% believe that President Trump's administration is dysfunctional, and 80% think Congress is dysfunctional. And we'll finish with a quote from Thomas Edison. He says famously, "I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.